Welcome to the Mycelium Network Podcast, a podcast for early stage web developers and the mentors, teachers, and communities that help them along the way. Hey, Becca, and welcome to the Mycelium Network Podcast.
Hello, thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. I've seen quite a few of your tweets and stuff on LinkedIn, and the more stuff I see, the more I'm like, you're just like the perfect guest for this podcast. Like, I can just imagine all the amazing things that junior devs especially and people new to open source is going to be able to learn from you. And so I'm really looking forward to this. I'm looking forward to this for the people who are going to be listening to this, because I think you've got some really great advice, but also just some inspirational stuff that I can't wait to talk about. Before we do that, if you could tell me and the listeners more about you, you know, how you've come to be where you are today, and like, yeah, what makes you excited about life and about technology?
Yeah, thanks so much. So I am Becca, and I'm a career changer. So prior to coming into tech, I spent 10 years teaching college English. And when I gave birth to my fourth child, I went through some major trauma. And through that experience, I found that I was really not sure who I was anymore. I was really struggling with mental health issues. And my husband said that I should learn to code. And I thought that just doesn't make any sense because I can barely function as it is, let alone have a complete thought. But he kept saying it. And so I decided, okay, I'm just gonna try it. So he stops asking me and telling me that I should try this. And what I found was that learning to code was really therapeutic for me. It stopped a lot of the repetitive thoughts and trauma in my head. And then as I was learning to code, I also found a wonderful community of people. So I networked with a lot of moms. I felt a lot of support that I hadn't in other spaces. And so for me, it just became this really healing journey. And it got to a point where I kind of had to make a decision. Do I want to continue teaching or do I want to just move into tech? And so I ended up getting a full scholarship to a boot camp, and I moved over to tech. And I spent the first year and a half doing mostly front end work. During the pandemic, I lost my job, so I accidentally started a tech community, which is still going today. And now I'm the developer experience lead at OpenSauce. So I've also found that it's been really great. I have four kids. My youngest is 7, my oldest is 14. And it's just been a really good experience to have a career and be surrounded by so many positive people that allows me to still spend time with my children and to afford a really good life for them.
Yeah, I have to say that is a perk of being in tech, right? Is having that freedom of being able to do the whole remote thing, and also, and through that, having more agency about your time, right? But of course, it depends on the company culture, and I think that's something we'll touch on during the conversation, because you have talked about how important culture is and how to figure out if you're a culture fit, because I think that's something people often forget. And it can have a major impact on your experience, especially if it's your first job, you know. And I don't know, your first job is almost like a first impression. You know, if your first job is bad, you can kind of think like, oh, did I make a mistake? And you might think that this is how tech is. Of course, there's always a second chance at a first impression also. So, you know, don't be too hard on yourself there. But but yeah, I mean, so there's a lot just in that you shared there. There's so much. And I think so something I started doing is I look at people's LinkedIn, and then, you know, below that you have the single line, the single sentence. And I kind of said like that's people's tagline. And I've been reading those in preparation for these conversations. And yours was just so cool. And with the stuff that you said now, I'm like, ah, wow, okay, this makes so much sense. So what it literally says is developer, community, and team builder, keynote speaker. So I would just like you to just riff off on those topics. Like how do those three topics, which seems maybe in a way separate things, How do they like kind of form a linear story or some kind of linear story?
Yeah, so for me, I was actually thinking a lot about this yesterday as I was taking a walk. Like, what is valuable or important in life? And what is important work, right? Because I hear people say like, oh, there are certain professional careers that it's not really important. It's just for entertainment. So why should people care? And you know, when it comes down to it, it's like, what is any of the work that we're doing important, right? And like, what makes it important? And so as I thought more deeply about that, it was, if we're doing something that connects us to other people, then for me, that's what's really important. And so much of the work that we do allows us to connect with people at a global scale, or it frees up time for us to connect with other people. And so when I think of what's valuable, it kind of goes in that direction. And so, you know, as a developer, we have all of these opportunities. And I think I really love remote work. I've only worked remotely as part of a team in tech. And it's been a great experience for me because I've been able to connect with people from all over the world. And as a community builder, I think I've talked to somebody in every single time zone that's out there. And prior to being in tech, I taught at a small college and I only talked to people who were in the Eastern time zone. And I mention that because now in tech, time zones are really hard, right? Trying to connect with people who are in other time zones, I'm like, okay, let me try and figure out if this is the Eastern time zone, which I never had to figure out before. So, but through that experience, you get such a diverse and rich experience of stories, of cultures, of sharing and understanding with each other. And so I think that, you know, being a developer, working on a team that does development, you have way more opportunities for that just because of, you know, the global reach of tech. And through that, we are able to form these communities that like further connect people, especially people who wouldn't have those connections. And the community that I started, Virtual Coffee, one of the most meaningful comments to me over the last 4 years of doing it was, somebody that was part of the community said, and I'm going to say this person is probably in their 30s. They said, I've never felt like I belong to a group before, and this is the first time I felt it. And, you know, to me, that was just such a special moment because I also kind of felt that way. I'm kind of an introvert. I have a hard time connecting with other people. I have ADHD, which sometimes makes relationships tricky as well. And when you're able to find those people, it just makes it so meaningful. And it's also really healing if you found that you're in a situation where you haven't been able to connect with people, because you can kind of gain a self-confidence that you may not have had before. So, and, you know, as part of that, like, I found that my experience in education, my experience as a teacher, just kind of like flows over all of these things as a developer, community builder, a team builder, because your classroom is kind of a small team, right? And you're thinking about like, how do I bring all of these different voices together? How do I represent them? How do I communicate to them in a way that everybody can understand? And how can I lead us forward so we're all growing in this space? And that just kind of goes along there. And it's the same thing for being a speaker, right? Like, you want to impact people by connecting them to the story you're telling or to the ideas that you have, so that when they leave that space, they're inspired to go and do something. You don't have to necessarily teach them something, but for me, giving a good talk is about inspiring them to grow and move forward.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And I mean, there's different kinds of talks, but I do find that I do enjoy the ones that kind of inspires action, right? That's like, and whether that's action that is meant to be like transformative, you know, in terms of like your life or somebody else's life, or whether it's just like a kick in the pants, you know, to like, hey, I've been really slacking and I should pick this thing, that thing, or the other thing up. It's so inspirational that this person, because I think we do need that in the world right now. It feels like the world is pretty overwhelming and it's in a strange place. And I think a lot of us And it, and I can understand it from a big perspective, that people just feel like, I'm just going through the motions and that's all I can really accomplish now, which, you know, I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. Sometimes that is what you need to do to just not go bonkers. But if there comes a time where somebody needs to stand up and say, but there's more to you than just going through the motions. And you kind of need that wake-up call. I think burnout plays into this and all that kind of stuff. So you've mentioned virtual coffee. What is virtual coffee?
We are a community of people in tech. So I want to just make sure to emphasize that broad term. So you don't have to be a developer. You could be learning. You could be someone who's been doing it for your entire career. You can be a founder, but at any point in the tech journey. And we're there to kind of support each other and to help each other grow. And I think that's really important that we have that growth mindset. So we get together twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And in between there, we also do a bunch of other activities. So we have things like a monthly challenge. We have small interest groups, and that just depends on, you know, what does the community need? So we have some accountability groups. We have a job hunt group. In the past, we've had a public speaking group, a React group. So essentially, we're just trying to find ways to bring value to the community, but also empower people to share in those experiences and to lead those experiences as well.
Yeah. So how do you get involved with this? Because I mean, I know I follow it like on Twitter. And so I see stuff every now and again, like pop up there. But, you know, if you want to like join this community, like where would be your first stop, so to speak?
So right now, we really strongly believe that it's important that everybody attend a virtual coffee before being invited into Slack. And the reason for that is you get this experience, a personal experience, to understand what the community is about. And so when you're able to interact with people, see how we talk to each other, then it kind of sets the tone for everything that you find in Slack. And it's not meant to be a drive-by community, and we intentionally keep it very small. So if you want a 19,000 person Discord, that's not us. You can find plenty of them out there. We're just a small group because we want to maintain that intimate conversation. So if you want to join, you can go to virtualcoffee.io/join. And then you just fill out a little information about you. And the reason why we have it that way is because it helps us figure out, like, can we support this person with the volunteers that we have? Because it's really important for us that we don't burn out our volunteers and that we know that we're the right path for the person who is applying. So I know it might seem like a lot of work to get into a community, but it's to help us to maintain these really special relationships that we have and to help everybody grow.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. I mean, I find that some of these really, really big, like you mentioned, Discord community server things, it's sometimes very hard. So you join and you're kind of like, whoa. And then I'll introduce myself. That's like the logical first step. So you do that. And then you're like, okay, now what do I do? And there's so much going on that you don't really know. And it's like, can I say this thing here? And it's really hard to get an answer because there's so much going on. Your conversation gets lost so easily if there isn't, because it's really hard to manage a large group like that, right? So, for example, enforcing certain policies of use threaded conversations, because otherwise you'll just blow somebody else's question away. Because if everybody just chats in like a linear fashion and you ask the question and a bunch of people just talk about something else, first of all, it kind of feels like you're interrupting because you're like inserting yourself in the middle of a conversation. But then at the same time, your question quickly gets lost as it scrolls out the viewport, right? Where if you use threaded conversations, then it's a little easier to manage that. But again, if you've got like 1,000, 2,000 people, like how do you ensure that everybody's using threaded? Some servers have tried a way of doing a bot, like as soon as you post something, it creates a thread, but that just feels a little too forced in a way. So I get that. I totally get that. Like the Mycelium network is also very small and I kind of prefer it that way. I think maybe we have a bit of an obsession about everything having to scale and be massive for it to be successful. I think maybe just the way we measure success is needs to be, we need to think about it differently. I don't know what you think about that.
It's so hard, right? And I know one of the challenges, of course, is there are costs that are associated with community. People are volunteering their time, so that's definitely one. As a community leader, you're spending your time supporting that community of people. But then there are other costs, like we record a podcast, so there's technology we have to pay for. We use Zapier to make things run smoothly in our Slack, and Zapier gets really expensive really quickly. And so you have to kind of think of how you cover that. And I'll never forget this one time I met with, I can't remember what his title was, but he was at a pretty popular tech company and pretty high up. And he agreed to meet with me to talk about sponsoring virtual coffee. And I wasn't asking for a lot of money, but the advice that he gave me was kind of, it was not building the type of community that I wanted to build, right? Like, if you want money, then you have to have people there. And you have to report on all of these numbers, and we need to understand that. And so you need to open up your doors, and you need to have more people. And like, this is not the community I'm trying to build. And I understand there's value in large communities, and I understand why companies want to sponsor large communities. But I will say, when you have a large community of people, sure, you're sponsoring them. Sure, you get in front of a larger group of people. But my theory is that they don't have the same relationships that smaller communities have. So are smaller communities who are more likely to vet and trust the people that are sponsoring them, do those translate, do those sponsorships have a higher success rate of translating into people using the product? Because by the nature of the community, everybody kind of trusts each other already. In a large community, I don't think that you have that same trust. It's like, oh, okay, cool, it's another sponsor, right? But in the small community, it's like, oh, they sponsored us. So there's like this personal connection that happens. And so I think that it's still valuable. But I think just kind of going back to the question, it can just be really hard sometimes to prove the value of the community if you want that type of support. But I will say, like, the thinking about it, what means success for a small community, I think you're right. It just like needs to be defined. What is the success of our community? Well, it's seeing people grow. It's seeing people level up. It's seeing people get jobs. It's seeing people get confident in what they're doing, right? All of those things define the success of our community. And it's never going to be a community that makes a ton of money or anything. That's not, we can never track our success by that metric. And so some of that is, I guess, most of it is qualitative. And this is the last thing I'll say, and then I'll stop talking. But I have this whole document about just the approach that we take at Virtual Coffee. And one of the last parts of it is talking about, we want to have a ripple effect. And this is how we gauge success. And so the idea is, when we treat each other with a person-centered approach, when we are kind to each other, empathetic, supportive, when we help people to grow, it shouldn't just be within Virtual Coffee. We should see it with all of the members that have come from through Virtual Coffee and have left. And it's okay if you leave, because Virtual Coffee might be a good place for you today, but you know, you might find that you don't need that same support in a month or 2 years or whatever. But what really makes us successful is that you take those core skills that we have exemplified in Virtual Coffee and you use them outside. And the idea is, like, when we do that, we make tech a better place.
Yeah, no, well said. And I mean, same thing, you know, I struggle with the exact same thing. It's like, for me, I also have a bit of an internal struggle when it comes to the numbers, simply not so much from sponsorships perspective, although that is something I'm starting to think about, because like you said, there are costs involved, of course, but, and you know, if you have some finances, you could do more potentially. But for me, it's like, if I'm putting on a podcast where people talk about their hopes, dreams, frustrations, and all these things, and I'm hoping to give them a platform where other people in tech can hear these things, and it could potentially open doors for them, or it could make people, you know, just sit, listen and say like, oh, wow, I had no idea that people are experiencing the interview process like this. This is the third person that said the same thing. We should probably. It feels like you need numbers for that to be meaningful, right? But then at the same time, I'm like, is it just numbers, or is it, like you said, an audience that's engaged? So you might not have 1,000 listeners, but the people who listen actually care, because you can have a bunch of people listening to it and be like, ah, these juniors, they're always complaining about this, that, and the other thing. That's not what you want, right? You don't really want those people to listen to it. You want people who's empathic and say like, wow, this person seems like they just need a start. Maybe we can do something. Or, hey, did you know that there's this, that, and the other opportunity for you? Did you know about virtual coffee? Blah, blah, blah. These kinds of things. So, yeah, there's this constant struggle between these two things. But I do think there's a lot to be said for smaller, intimate communities, both from a benefit to the people in the community, but also for the sponsors. Because if there's just a sponsor in a community of 10,000 people, it's like, there's so much noise. Do people even ever pay attention to it? Do they even know when the sponsor changes, kind of thing? Whereas if you have a small community, they first of all, like you said, trust. And trust is so important. But they're also going to feel like, for example, they trust you as the kind of founder of this whole thing. And they're going to say, well, if these people are sponsoring, obviously Becca is cool with that, so she trusts them and that they are good and do a good job, so therefore I'm trusting it. So I think that there's, you know, I do think there's value that we need to unlock in some strange way, but we'll figure it out. Hiring, firing, and becoming indispensable. That's a big one, and that's a post you wrote. And by the way, the post you write in your blog is just incredible. Like, it must take you quite some time to write those. It's really, really good. Those words is going to ring true for a lot of people right now, and has been for the last year or so, unfortunately. Like, I find looking at my LinkedIn timeline sometimes incredibly depressing, but I repost so many people in a day saying, like, I need a new... going for, you know, trying to be positive, you know, saying like, oh, I'm going on the next part of my journey, that kind of thing. And then after 2-3 weeks, you see their motivation start dropping as they can't find work and that kind of thing. So big topic, but what do we do in a economy and in an environment like this, where there's so much, there was a lot of hiring, now there's a lot of firing. How do we deal with all of that stuff, and how do we kind of find a place where we can feel a little bit more sure about the future?
Yeah, I think it's a really great question. It is a really hard one to answer. And I think my heart goes out to everybody that's experiencing that. I think it was right about a year ago, I was laid off from my job, and it didn't feel good, right? There were definitely warning signs that one of my friends in virtual coffee was like, Becca, the ship is sinking for you. Get off the ship. And I just couldn't, you know, I just felt like I need to stay here. And I can't even explain why. But leaning into communities becomes a really important part of this. And that's actually why I started virtual coffee. So when the pandemic hit, I had been working in my first job. I was there for about 9 months. The first 6 months, I felt like I was drowning. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. I shouldn't be a developer. When I'm going to get fired? And like, this has nothing to do with the person I worked for. It's just personally, there were a lot of hurdles I had to overcome. And then the next 3 months, I felt like, yeah, we're getting in stride. We're doing what we need to be doing. And then the pandemic hit. And the day I went to pick up my kids' books from school, I also lost my job. So it was like utter hopelessness. And I was really interviewing for the very first time, because that first job, it was a conversation. This sounds like a good fit for me. Is it a good fit for you? Yep. And that was it. So, you know, I was interviewing for the very first time, and there was this moment where I'll never forget, my office was out in my bedroom, and I have a bathroom that connects to my bedroom. And I think he was like 5 years old at the time, he like walked by while I was in an interview, left the door open to my bathroom and peed. And I was just like, this is absurd. You know, there's just nothing else. And I just remember, I cried every single night. It was so hard. And then I finally remember, just based on my experience with trauma, the best thing that you could do is not be isolated. But it was a pandemic, so we were all isolated, right? And so I put a tweet out there, like, who wants to meet up for virtual coffee? And this was in April of 2020. We've been going ever since then. But what I found in that community was all of this hopelessness that I was feeling, other people were experiencing it as well, right? And so then there was just like a real connection with people, and sometimes just knowing you're not the only person that's going through this is really helpful. You know, like, wow, I went to this interview and I thought I crushed it, and then they went with somebody else. That doesn't feel good. But when someone else was like, yeah, I went through that too, we're like, okay, then I'm not alone, because somebody else feels this way. And yeah, it's frustrating. And I know that there are people that have been looking for jobs for a year now. But when you can lean into your community, like, sometimes they help you, but they also push you a little bit too, right? Like, there have certainly been people that I know have just been kind of stuck and not been able to move forward. And I've seen the community encourage them, like, okay, why don't you try this? Or, you know, why don't you get some experience speaking, give a lunch and learn, or speak on a podcast or something like that. And I think anytime you do that, you can kind of build momentum and you can build experience as well. And so that just kind of keeps you moving forward. And sometimes, like you said, sometimes you just have to, it's not ideal, but you have to get up and you have to do it anyway, even when you don't want to. And there's something that you should definitely rest. Rest is good, especially if you're feeling burnt out. But know that you're going to have another chance. It's just about finding that chance. And when you find yourself a community of people that you could grow with, this also becomes your network. And I always like to say, like, your network isn't the people you know, it's the network of your network. And so this expands so much further. So the more that you build solid relationships with other people, the more likely they are to recommend you for a role and to grow your network as well. And so I'd say, like, find those ways that you can keep moving forward. And I know, I think everybody has their own thing that motivates them. And I was also thinking a lot about this yesterday too. What motivates me? And I got that question in an interview once, and my answer was momentum. Like, I like to keep moving forward. And there are definitely going to be times where you can't keep moving forward, or you have to stop and you have to look back over all of the things that you've done. But understanding that momentum is helpful for me, then in those times where I feel stuck or where I feel like I can't do this one more day, then I need to start to think about, okay, how can I gain momentum in the things that I enjoy doing and that I want to do? And how can that get me motivated to do the things that I don't want to do? So I think that, you know, finding that motivation becomes a really core part of the experience.
Yeah. So with that in mind, like, right now, you know, when you apply for a position, it's a bit of a sea of resumes that you're going to be part of, right? Because there's just so many engineers that's in the job market right now. So, you know, ignoring stuff like the reduce in pay and that kind of stuff, which kind of goes with that thing, because now if it's an employer's world, then, you know, they can kind of dictate, right? Which is not ideal. I mean, we don't really want that kind of economy, but this is where we are. So, but within that, like I said, ignoring all of that, the fact that there are a sea of resumes that you are a part of means that there's something you need to do to stand out. Now, you could do stuff like, for example, dress up your resume so it's not just another A4 with black and white on it. You know, like, something I did way back before I joined Mozilla is I used their color scheme, I used their font, I talked in their voice, all that kind of stuff. These things help. But I do think that quite a few people will probably these days not just look at the PDF you sent them, but they will follow the links in there. And I think that's where you get this chance to, as you say, tell your story. So how do you make sure that when they leave that PDF and they look at your life online, how do you ensure that you tell a story where people are like, huh, I want to work with this person?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And, you know, I think that this comes down to the both the idea of being indispensable and the talk that I gave the other day, which was on core skills in the job hunt, right? And so you have to prove that you're indispensable, right? And that's really important. So what does that even mean? Well, being indispensable means that you're a person that they need to keep on the team or they need to have on the team. So you need to have some skills that probably fill a gap on the team. And we recognize that everybody has different strengths. So first of all, identify what are your strengths? What are you good at? And I'll never forget, actually, after I'd been laid off one of the two times, I reached out to a friend of mine that I consider a mentor, and I was just really upset. And he's like, okay, Becca, do a self-evaluation. What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? What are you going to do next? And that was like really helpful to switch my frame of mind from being, I'm very upset at this situation, to let's turn around and move forward. And how do we move forward and understand? It comes down to an understanding of ourselves, first of all. We have to know who we are and we have to be able to tell that story effectively. And it's hard to tell it in a resume. I understand that. But there are all of those extra experiences that you can add to the resume. And I can say I'm on a hiring committee for a community organization at home. So it's not a tech organization, but we're kind of going through this process now. And so I get to see it from the interviewer perspective. And so of course I'm Googling all of the people who have applied to the position and trying to get a better understanding of who they are and how can they lead, because that's essentially what we're looking for, somebody who would be a good leader. And so first of all, like, understand the job description. Look at what they're asking for. And try and see, how do your strengths match up to those things? Or how do your weaknesses pair up with those things? If you can, reach out to somebody in the company and get a better understanding. You're never going to hurt yourself doing more research about a company or doing more research about your interviewer. It's going to give you a better understanding of how to frame your story in a way that allows you to connect to them. And then tell on your resume, tell the most important experience. So I looked at a resume. I don't even know. It had to have been 7 pages long, right? I don't need your entire life story. I want to know what's important about you and how it matches to the role that I am filling. So I personally really like on a resume, a relevant experience section, because it allows me to see like, okay, these are the skills this person has, and it directly translates to this thing. And so sometimes it's really helpful, and I encourage people to do this, take the job description and then go line by line, how have I done this? Write it out. How have I done this? Write it out. And then it becomes easier to match it, especially if the person who has written it is matching for the role. They're going to see like, oh, this person is exactly what we want, because you have exactly matched the information there. And then you want the people that are reviewing your resume to understand what's important or what's special about you. And so for me, I'm pretty sure there's a section of my resume that talks a little bit about what I've done at Virtual Coffee, because for me, that's led to the majority of all of my job offers in the last couple of years, because, you know, I've created a community and sustained it through all of these different stages of the world and through the people who have come through there. And so that's a big part of my story. I link to my blog where I talk about a lot of different things, but you get a sense of my personality and the things that I value. And so, like, for me, I'm a mom of 4 kids. And I know that some people will say, don't talk about your kids because it will exclude you. Well, you know what? I don't want to work for a company that doesn't want me to be a mom of my 4 kids. That's important to me. Now, if you really need a job, and that it's totally valid to not talk about your kids and to not have any reference to them, right? Because you don't want to be excluded. So I think, like, really thinking about what you need is really important too. And, you know, sometimes people will say that job's not offering you enough money. It is a hard market out there too. So sometimes you have to take the job that doesn't offer that much money. But I can't remember who said it to me, but there's a big jump between junior salary and mid-level salary. And so even though you may be taking a job at the junior level that doesn't pay that much, you should see it be made up for when you jump to that mid-level salary. So sometimes it's an investment in the journey and how you're going to grow there. As you're trying to decide whether or not this is the right role for you. So, and again, like I say this because everybody's journey is going to look different. So people will give you tons of advice on how to find a job or what the right job is or what the right salary is. And it really comes down to you. And my last manager prior to being on the open source team, I reached out to him to talk about salary when I was looking for a new job and saying like, okay, I was offered this job that it's a lot less than what I had been making. I don't really know what to do with that information. And he said, well, when you were hired before, that's when the job market was doing really well. So nobody at this point should expect to be hired at those salaries. And that was really useful information to me. But if I didn't have that network or that connection or relationship with my former manager, then I wouldn't have understood that, right? And I could have, you know, let a really good opportunity pass me by because of that. So I kind of got off track there with telling your story. But the point is, like, to be able to understand what you need, who you are, and then connect that with what they're looking for.
Yeah, no, that's great. You totally didn't go off topic. I think it was all very much on topic. And I, the part where you talked about speaking to the job description, I think that is so important. I equate that with when you send somebody an email and they reply to you and they ask a question that you know you already answered in your original email. It's like, you didn't even read my email, did you? So I think speaking to it like that, first of all, it makes your CV very apt and you know, appropriate for the position you're applying, because you can tailor it. But the person reading it's gonna say, oh, they actually read this thing. I can see it because they are talking directly to these things that we are asking for. And I think that is going to already put you above a lot of the other folks, even if you have less experience, just because they can see you have an attention to detail and you actually read things and then talk to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's so important.
Yeah, no, that's critical. And so open source. So you're at Open Sourced. So you all do a bunch of really cool work regarding open source and figuring out how healthy projects are and where you're going and all these kinds of things. I spoke to Bidagi on my other podcast, Mechanic Link, where we talked all things open source. And I've been like, I think you mentioned in the beginning that you've been doing like remote work since you basically, you know, transitioned into tech and like that. And I've been doing it for so long that when I had this short period of time where I was doing freelance kind of work. And so I worked with clients and they were not doing open source stuff. And it was so weird to not just be open about everything, you know, having to remind yourself, oh, whoops, I can't tweet about this, or I can't share about this, or I can't build in public. I can't stream my my work to Twitch. This stuff is like confidential. But the other thing that I find with open source, and like I've been talking about this to death, so people are probably bored from hearing me say this, but I just think open source, everything around open source. So people think like, oh, you mean code? And I'm like, no, not just the code. That's just one small aspect of it. What I'm talking about is the experience of being part of, and again, we're going back to community, being part of the open source community. I think there is so much there for you, whether you're starting out, whether you're mid-level, whether you're senior, doesn't matter. There's a lot of things that happens around the code that is so important to learn. And it helps you because when you walk into a work environment, a lot of the things that apply in open source apply within a work environment. So I think one of the things that I found with junior devs is, one, they struggle to find birds of a feather, right? They struggle to find people who share their interests, but also are where they are at, you know, who can talk to the same pains and struggles. The second thing they struggle with is experience. How the heck do I get experience? Nobody wants to give me a chance. How do I get my first job if I can't even get experience? You know, that's just a self-fulfilling prophecy, and they get down about this stuff. I think open source can do a lot to solve that problem, and it's going to teach you more than just how to write JavaScript. It's going to teach you how to do problem solving. It's going to teach you how to work in a team, how to be part of a community, how to do marketing, how to write good documentation, why that's even important, because you'll learn that quickly when you try to contribute to a project that has bad documentation. You'll quickly learn like, oh, that's why documentation is important, because otherwise you wouldn't even know how to contribute to this thing. So seeing that you're right in the thick of all of this, how do you think about all of this stuff? Like, and you also, Virtual Coffee plays into this, right? How do you think about the role of open source in education, learning, and building that foundation that you talked about in your talk about core strengths?
Yeah, so I am a big proponent of open source, as you know. But I think that it's really complex, right? Because one of the things that we find in open source is that maintainer burnout is super high, right? And there's not enough being done to support maintainers. And so one of the reasons why is there's kind of this trend around using open source to replace a boot camp or something like that. And I want to say that it's not the same. There are repositories that are super friendly to beginners. So it's important that if you're new to open source, or if you're new to the open source ecosystem, to find a repository that is welcoming to you. And so I will just go ahead and say that at OpenSost, we have an intro course where you get your first contribution. And we have another repository called the Pizzaverse, which allows you to build on those skills and to practice a little bit more. And so the idea there is, when you're contributing to open source, you're learning new skills. So there's definitely, there's new terminology that you're using. And so I'm a bootcamp grad myself. I maybe created like 5 pull requests when I was in bootcamp. That was all. So even like getting my first job, like, okay, I create a pull request for this thing, right? You know, it was just not built into the curriculum in a way that it made it natural for me to continue to move forward. So I had to learn more about how to use GitHub and, you know, all of the tools that make it easier for me. So I'd say, number one, find a place that is welcoming for new contributors, because that's going to make it easier for you and more beneficial. Number two, I think that exactly what you're saying, that this open source teaches you so many things that you don't learn in bootcamp, you probably don't learn in college, that you don't learn working on your own. That's collaborating with other people. And one of the most important things that you can do is learn how to be a good communicator and practice good core skills. So in my talk, I talked about the importance of listening, communication, problem solving, and storytelling. And so I'll just give kind of a brief overview of how I think these things translate to what we're talking about here. So number one, you have to be a good listener. If you're a contributor and you submit, before you even submit a pull request, this is when you start listening. And how do you listen? You read the README of a project and you understand what it's saying there, right? The README of the project tells you what the project's about and probably how to run the project. Now, if you want to contribute, you'll probably find linked in that README is a contributing.md file. So then you go and read the contributing.md file. And it's important, before you ever ask a maintainer, how do I get started, that you've done those two things, because it shows that you value their time and that you listen to the steps that they've already set up for you to help you succeed, because that's what maintainers are ultimately doing with documentation. They're helping you succeed. So And then once you have created a pull request, you're likely to get feedback. And I think that's one of the big things. People are like, oh, I created a pull request and the requested changes, I failed, which is like not true, right? Because everybody gets a pull request review and then there are changes that people ask for. It's a normal part of the journey. So you're fine, keep going with it, but listen to what the maintainers say. And so when that reviewer reviews your pull request, if they say like, hey, you should, let's take documentation for an example. You've written about this from a particular perspective, but I need you to write it from the perspective of a JavaScript developer or whatever. Instead of just changing that one section, you need to go through the whole pull request and update that information. Again, this shows that you're listening to the reviewer and that you value their time. It also shows one of the other skills, problem solving. How have you approached the problem? Are you able to take that feedback and implement it using, you know, your own thought process and your hard work? And then are you able to communicate that back to the maintainer or whoever is reviewing your PR? And I will say, you know, sometimes the maintainer doesn't get it right. And you might say, okay, this is why I chose this particular approach. Is there a reason why I would do it in a different way? And it's valid to have that conversation. And this is why it's valuable, right? You're growing your communication skills and you're doing it in public. I for sure have seen comments in open source where I was like, I would never hire that person in my entire life because of how they responded to that pull request, you know? And so when we do this, we're just demonstrating the kind of teammate that we'll be. And no one expects you to get it right all of the time, but what we do expect is to see growth. And that's what anybody wants to see if they're hiring someone. Like, have you grown through your experiences? And how can you talk about that? And then that's when the storytelling comes into play. And I will always say that, you know, when you overcome challenges, where, you know, neurologically speaking, we root for underdogs, right? There's a spark that happens in us and neurochemicals that just start bursting when we see somebody who is faced with a challenge and they have to overcome that challenge. We start to root for them. And so when you're able to say like, I've had this challenge and I didn't give up, this is how I went through and how I did it, then somebody's more likely to connect with you and say like, that's the person I want. They have grit, they have tenacity, or you know, whatever you want to call it, but you're demonstrating that and you're showing that you can do it as part of a team and that you can communicate really well. And I'll just say one last thing before I stop talking again for a minute, but there was a couple of years ago, I think I was talking to somebody that runs an agency of that focuses on a particular technology. And they were saying that they generally only hire senior plus developers because of their code experience, but that I might be a good fit for the team because of my communication skills. And they said, you know, we can level up your code really quickly and your ability to write code. What makes your strength intriguing for us is that you're able to communicate to a wide variety of audiences, and that's a skill that's harder to level up. So if you can demonstrate those skills, that's going to become incredibly important to your success in landing a job or finding a network of people. And when you're contributing to open source, if the maintainers see like, wow, this person is really doing an amazing job communicating with us, then they're also more likely to recommend you to other people because there's a network of maintainers and of open source people that talk about these things and that do hire.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I can attest to that. I mean, you know, I've seen this time and time again where a contributor comes to a project, they make a small contribution and everything, it goes really well. Again, not to say there was no request for changes. There probably were, which is fine. Like you said, 100% expected, because oftentimes you walk into a project without a lot of context and you might think that the way you did this thing, it makes 100% sense. But then if you learn the context, like, oh, I see. Okay, well, in that case, let me go and refactor or rework this. But then that contributor is like, cool, thanks so much for this. This was great. And they come back and they contribute again. What I've found time and time again is that now the maintainers start to talk to one another. It's like, hey, man, that other person has come back and they have another pull request. It's really, really good. Their work is really great. Now you're starting to speak to that person and say, hey, so where are you from? What are you doing? Now there's a friendship starting to evolve. And you never know when one of those folks could be at a company that you would love to work at. Now you have that, and, you know, make of it what you will, but if you have somebody on the inside rooting for you, that is a big, big boon for your career. And it's gonna increase your chances of getting the job a lot. Of course, you need to then prove that they aren't just saying stuff about you that's untrue. That's where it's cool when you're in open source, because you have open examples. Like, go look at the work I did there. You know, it's like, it's right there, it's open, it's not hidden, anything like that. Because I know I struggled with that for a long time in the beginning, where all the companies I worked at was like proprietary, closed source kind of thing. So people would say, do you have experience with this? And it's like, yeah, I do, but I can't show you because it's behind an intranet. So, you know, you can't see it. I think those are one of the great things about open source. It's like, it's right there. It's not hidden, it's open. But it goes both ways. If you're being a not so nice person, that's also right there in the open for everybody to see.
Right, right. And right along with that too, you know, if you're not being nice, that's definitely a red flag. But another thing that I want to mention that I don't hear people talk about often is you want to see your contributors grow as well, right? So if somebody keeps taking issues and they haven't completed their old issues, or if they need help and they need you to walk them through step by step every single issue, then again, that's like one of those things that becomes, it shows that you're not really respecting the maintainer's time if you're constantly asking them to walk you through every single thing. And that goes back to being a problem solver. So if you want to show that you're really willing to grow, then you have to be able to put in that work and to be a problem solver. And there's nothing wrong with asking for help. So I want to make sure that it's clear that that's not what I'm saying here. I'm not saying don't ask for help if you get stuck. But if you're taking on issue after issue after issue, and you need help on all of those issues, then I think that you need to reevaluate what your strengths are and how you interact with the open source team.
Yeah, I think it's also being self-aware and being able to. I think one of the things that we as humans find hard is, maybe we struggle on both sides, but we struggle to admit to what we're our weak points. I think if somebody asks you, what is your weak points? You kind of don't want to say. It's like, well, I don't think I have any, because you think that's what they want to hear, right? Like, oh, you're just an amazing person. Everything you do is just, it's like, no, they're actually trying to see if you can admit to the fact that, you know what, when it comes to TypeScript, I just want to run away. Like, you know, that's a very technical thing, but, you know, it's something that you're admitting to. But at the same time, you can follow that up, but I'm always eager to learn. And I'm always eager to try something. And I think that's what you need to do in those situations is say, be self-aware and say like, oh man, I can't go back to this person again and ask the same question. I've asked this a billion times. Why do I keep getting stuck at this point? Is there something I can do for myself? Can I write it down somewhere so I have something to refer back to if I hit that same problem again? Can I make a little bit of notes? And then who knows, that might be a useful contribution in the future, because other people might hit the same thing and you might say, you know what, this has become really useful to me. Should I add this in the docs? And the maintainer might say, wow, yeah, that's amazing. That's a great, and here you go. Here's another contribution.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we have our community maintainer team at OpenSauced. One of the maintainers, IU, did a really great job of doing exactly that. kind of documenting the pain points that we've had as new maintainers, as people like looking at projects for the first time, and created this step-by-step guide. And the idea is that it's not set in stone, right? It's going to expand and it's going to grow based on who becomes the community maintainer. But that should be a good guide, not only for new maintainers at OpenSauce, but for everyone. And we're kind of pulling from that guide in our intro to maintainer course as well, because we want to equip maintainers with the information that they need to succeed.
Yeah, so then as maintainers, how do we give good feedback?
Ah, that's such a good question. I have a whole talk on feedback that I've given, and there's this one story that I want to tell. This was a really interesting question that I got after the talk. And so this, maybe he was like principal engineer or just, you know, past the senior level of engineering. And he came up afterwards and he said, you know, I am good at engineering. I'm good at writing code. I am not good at talking to other people. How do I get better at that? And I really appreciated that self-awareness, because I could tell he's like really sincere. Like, I want to get better. I keep getting feedback that I'm really not a good person to talk to. And he wanted to grow in that way. And so one of the things about feedback is, I think to give good feedback, you have to really know the person that you're talking to, right? And I've heard people say that, you know, sometimes I wait to give feedback to a new employee for a couple of months because I want to develop a relationship with them and a rapport. And there's a reason why you do that. And that's because when you trust someone else, when you believe that they have your best interest in mind, then you're more likely to accept their feedback. And then the second part of that is to give them feedback at a time that works for them. And I think I may use this example in my talk, but like, if I'm coming home and I'm carrying like 20 bags of groceries up the steps and my kids are all yelling at me, and then someone says like, hey, you didn't put away the cheese after you made lunch. Can you make sure that you do that next time? Like, even though that's not really a bad comment, like that's good and helpful feedback, it's like, can't you just put it away? Can't you see how busy I am? You know, I'm not ready when I'm carrying 20 bags of groceries to have that feedback, right? But when I'm like sitting down and maybe relaxing for the day, then that's a good time to say like, hey, you know, you left the cheese out today. I put it away, but you know, I've noticed that you sometimes forget to do that after you make lunch. And I know that you're busy, but can you try to make an effort to do that? Like, oh yeah. Then at that point, I'm like, oh yeah, thanks for putting it away. And I'm sorry, I'll try to do a better job of that or whatever. And so I think it's like finding that space. And I'm think that it's important that you don't wait too long to give feedback, right? Because I've definitely made the mistake where I've put off giving someone feedback for a while. And then I've given them that feedback and they're like, well, why didn't you tell me this before? You know, I've been making the same mistake for 2 months now because you didn't tell me, like, because I didn't want to have the conversation because it's hard sometimes, you know? But if you recognize that it's valuable to both you and that person, then sometimes it's useful to let the person know, like, hey, in a month, let's sit down and talk about this. Or, you know what? I never like to do this. I don't like this. So if someone says on Friday afternoon, hey, do you want to catch up on Monday so I can give you some feedback? Like, no, because I'm going to worry about it all weekend long, you know? So I'd say, you might say to someone like, hey, I would really like to give you some feedback this week. When is a good time for me to do that? And you do it on a Monday or something, right? And then you kind of show that you're acknowledging that this other person is busy and that they have other obligations and that you want them to be in the right headspace to receive that feedback. And then they are able to kind of feel more in control over the situation, right? And sometimes I'll even offer like, there are different modes that we can have a conversation. We can have a video call. I could send you an audio message or I can type it out. Please let me know which is best for you. And as the person giving the feedback, I think that that depends on your strengths too. If you feel that you have a hard time communicating and writing, then don't offer that, right? Because it's not going to work. But it's really kind of a complex process. But then recognizing that it's important for the growth of the person to give them that feedback then you're really helping them and you're helping your team as well. So I think that it's important to remember that hard conversations, they are hard. We have to have them sometimes. It's what makes us good teammates and good leaders. And then the last thing I'll say about it is, I don't think anybody should ever be surprised by the feedback that you're giving them. And that's kind of the scenario where I didn't give someone feedback for a long time. And they were like out of nowhere hit with that. But I think if you're building in kind of like constant feedback loops, that's really important. And as part of that feedback, you should always be telling them the things that they're doing well too. So like, oh, wow. That was really great the way that you reviewed that PR. I really appreciated that. That's a good motivator for people. And when you understand your strengths, it allows you to kind of lean into them and then to evaluate what your weaknesses are.
Yeah, that's amazing. I resonated so much with that on a Friday, getting a thing like this, like one-on-one random impromptu meeting with your manager on a Monday. And you're like, what's happening? Am I getting fired? What did I do wrong? And it's like, and then Monday comes around and you're like sitting there and you're so stressed out. And they're like, I just wanted to tell you that you're doing an exceptional job. And you're like, you should have led with that on Friday.
So, yeah, just send me a DM next time.
So I always like, if you're going to say something like, I want to give you some feedback, I'll set up a meeting for us on Monday, lead with, everything's fine. You're doing a great job, but I just have some additional stuff to tell you and I don't have time today, but we'll speak on Monday. Then I can have a weekend.
Yeah, exactly.
Otherwise, my weekend is ruined. I'm going to stress the entire weekend. Yeah, that's hilarious, but I so resonated with that. That was great advice. That was really, really good. I think one of the things that I tend to try to do, I sometimes forget, but I try to remind myself to do that, is the thing you said about like saying something positive. Like if you're doing because I put myself in that person's shoes. And if you open a pull request and all you get back is negative stuff, like negative in the sense that change this, change that, oh, this could be better, da, da, da. It can sometimes feel a little bit demotivating, right? It's like, ah, man, I suck. First of all, you don't. We all suck. It's fine. But secondly, so if you just add that something about, by the way, this was really good. I really like the fact you did. And it can be something small. It can be that they added a really good comment to their code. They commented a function really well. It's like, oh, thanks so much for adding this. A lot of people don't think about this, and this makes a big difference. That kind of offsets all the, please change this, oh, this could be a little bit better, this could be like that. And then the other thing that I like to do is, if I have a suggestion about something, then I didn't come up with this, I learned this from somebody else, I end it with, what do you think? So it's not like a one-sided thing where it's like, I'm just telling you to do something. I'm kind of like, I think this could be refactored into a single function. What do you think?
Yeah, and I will say the other part of this, and you kind of mentioned it there, is being really specific with your feedback as well, especially the positive feedback. And I remember this one story. I was flying to give a talk, maybe in Wisconsin, about feedback. And before I got on the plane, my boss, B. Dougie, messaged me. He DM'd me and said something about, like, hey, I know you're about to get on a plane, but I just wanted to say that this thing that you've been doing is really, you've been doing a really great job. And he gave a line explanation about why I was doing a good job. And I like almost teared up in the airport, because there's a difference between someone saying you're doing a good job and then you're doing a good job and specifically this is why. And I think that it just better helps us connect. And I think that oftentimes maybe it's just because we get that blanket. Oh yeah, you're doing a good job. All the time, where it has lost some of its meaning. Like, am I really doing a good job? Or do you just want to placate me or just not have this conversation? Or you just don't have any feedback because I'm doing neutral? I'm not sure. But when you're specific with someone, then it also helps them to see, like, okay, this is a strength for me. And this is also how I'm impacting the business. And it feels good to know that you're doing something that helps the business grow.
For sure, for sure. That is almost, for me, the thing I need to kind of be reminded about constantly from those that I work with is the fact that you're doing meaningful work and you're contributing to the growth and success of the company. Because oftentimes it can feel like I'm doing a bunch of stuff, but is it even making a difference to anybody? Or is it even making a difference to you? Because sometimes you can make a difference to somebody else, and through doing that, they can do a better job, which then leads to an outcome, right? And you don't get to see the whole chain. So it's nice if somebody says, hey, you know what? This thing you did, it's saving me a bunch of time. And because of that, I've been able to do this thing and it's been having an impact on the business. It's like, ah, awesome. Now I know I'm doing something worthwhile. I think it's super important to do that. To shift gears to something in open source related, but like completely different now. You've been writing this cool series on Dev2, 29 days of open source. I think you're almost done if you're not already done.
I'm done.
Yay. Okay. Just doing your thing like that for 29 days, that is impressive as hell. To tell you, it's like, it's so hard. I've done series before, but it takes a lot to keep going. What have you learned from that? Like, so it's called 29 Days of Open Source Alternatives, right? What have you learned through this 29 days of looking for and writing about open source alternatives?
Yeah, so I've learned a lot, and I'm actually going to talk more about it in the newsletter that comes out on Monday. But some of the takeaways, I think, are it's really encouraging to see a strong community in the open source project. And so the very first post I did, I think, was on Godot. And Godot just crushes it, right? They've seen a lot of growth in the last year, and part of that is came in response to the changes in Unity, because Unity changed their pricing structure. And so a lot of people really were strong proponents of switching over to Godot. But you can see contributors across their graph, and they have so many people there, which is good for a number of reasons. But one, if you want to be involved in an open source project and have your questions answered and have support, having a thriving community is really important, because sometimes what you find in small projects is that the maintainers are working so hard to keep up with all of their tasks that it can be really hard to make sure that you're answering all the questions that you're getting. So when you have a large community like that, you're probably going to have your questions answered. Another thing that I learned is if you look at the star to fork ratio of a project as a metric of success. We often see that stars are held as a metric of success, but they're more of, I want to say, like a vanity or a marketing metric, which there's nothing wrong with that. But if we want to see the active contributions there, then it's better to say like, okay, how many people are forking this? Because those are the people that are working on the project. And if you have a high or I'm trying to think of who did I do yesterday? Hugging Face. I did Hugging Face yesterday, and their start to fork ratio for their top three repositories in the last 30 days was almost equivalent. And you also see the same thing. You see a really great community there that's willing to work on the project, to engage, to answer questions and things like that. And then there was one more takeaway that I wanted to share here. What was I going to say? I feel like it's just on the tip of my tongue, but I can't say it. It will definitely be in the newsletter if anyone wants to read the newsletter. But I think that, you know, we evaluate the success of projects, we evaluate the growth of projects in different ways, but it's really great to see the transparency that happens in open source projects, because I think it allows you to make a much more informed decision about the things that you're using, the approaches that are being taken, and to understand what it looks like for the team who's developing those things.
Yeah, yeah. Open source is amazing. It really is. okay. This has been there's so much that's been in this conversation. It's been incredible. Thanks so much, Becca. I have like two things at the end. The one I just came up with, so it's not really a curveball. I'm sure you're up to it. If I'm new to open source, be it I'm a junior at the same time or not, doesn't matter really. What are the things I should look out for that will give me some indication that this could be a welcoming community. This could be the project for me where I can start my journey.
So I like to think of what the contributor path looks like, or the contributor journey. And so one of the things, I can't remember who said it. I know that I talked to Rachel Neighbors and they had really great input into it. And then I think I talked to someone from Astro, and they both, it was back to back weeks, and they were both saying some really great things about what the contributor journey should look like. But the idea is that we want our contributors to grow. So it doesn't, we don't want to see them, you know, not exercising those muscles or growing as developers or in writing documentation. And so if you find an organization that allows you to grow, I think that's a really great way to say, like, okay, this person is here, or this organization is here to kind of see me through this journey. And so they've created clear documentation. And for me, that's huge, because, oh, maybe this is the other thing I was going to say about open source projects, that documentation is so key, right? There is, I can't remember what project, I wouldn't have mentioned it anyway, but there's one project I was going to write about, but I could not tell you what the project did, really, because the documentation was so sparse that I wouldn't be able to figure out how to run the project. And I also couldn't tell you what a use case for the project was as well. And I understand, like, small teams, that can be really challenging. But it would be great to see, if you're having trouble with documentation, having issues written up there where at least you're outlining some of the things that you're hoping to get from contributors. But anyway, documentation is important. And it's important to see whether or not, you know, this is a welcoming project as well. And I actually, this is another takeaway. Good labeling goes a long way, right? Some issues, some repositories, you look at the issues and there's no labels on those issues, which makes it really hard to sort. And I understand why maintainers don't label. Sometimes you just don't have the time. Sometimes your contributors aren't labeling the issues that they're creating. There are lots of different reasons why that might happen. But when you see labels on issues, it makes it easier for you to sort and to understand whether or not that's an issue for you. So if you're new, you might want to look at good first contribution labels or beginner friendly labels. And so at OpenSauced, in the community repos, we have a rule that you can have a good first issue one time, because it's a good first issue, right? It's not a good second issue if it says first. And that's to give lots of people a chance to get started. And then after that, we try to write issues that are good. We don't have a label for good second issue, but we're working on creating, like, beginner friendly issues out there. So if you've done a first one, but you're still nervous, then you can kind of continue along that path and grow there. So I think that having labels makes it really friendly for somebody who's new there. And then also, I would say, look in the comments on issues, on PRs, if there's a discussion board, look in there and see how people are communicating with each other. Because a lot of what happens in open source is async communication, which can be really, really hard. But if you can see that there are people who are talking back to each other, they're commenting, they're supporting each other, then that's probably more likely a really good place for you to get started.
Great advice. Moms learn tech.
That's a Markdown repository that I have. And so this is maybe my first real open source project where I invited contributors. But when I was learning to code, I had a great network of moms who were really helpful in helping me to grow. And so I thought it would be really great to have resources for moms out there. And why moms specifically? Well, there's, like, a lot of things that go into being a mom, learning how to code and getting a job. And so, like, part of that is, like, is this a good company for somebody who has children? Because sometimes you'll see that there's no flexibility in time off, or you have to work 9 to 5. So that means you have to arrange childcare. So for me, you know, my work schedule is flexible. And that allows me to pick up my kids from school every day or to go on their field trips with them, right? So those are things that are important to me. Or they offer paid maternity leave. What does their maternity leave look like? Is it 2 weeks? Is it 3 months? You know, what are the expectations there? So it's a way to keep track of resources to help support moms and what they're doing as they grow in their tech journey.
Amazing. That's a great resource. Because I know I've talked about this to many people before, not in podcasts, but just like privately, about the fact that admitting, I don't know, especially when I was younger, I had this definite feeling that people were not keen when they asked the question, which I don't think you should be allowed to ask, but whatever. Are you planning on having children? And especially that asked that to women. And I'd be like, first of all, that seems like a weird interview question. And secondly, none of your business. And third, what if I say yes? Are we done here? And are we just like going to have a nice, pleasant conversation, but you've already made up your mind here? So I think having, and unfortunately for some companies, that is the truth. Like if your answer is yes, that interview is technically done and they're not interested because they want people who are going to be available every day at any time when anything happens. And knowing that is super important because I worked at a company like that and it was, wow, it destroyed me. Like I thankfully found Mozilla through, but I did reckless stuff, right? Like I quit my job before I even had the job in Mozilla because I was just done. I was just freaking done. I think having a resource where you can be like, you don't have to necessarily call out the bottles, but you could say, these are the good people. These are the good companies. These are the companies that's like, we don't care about your personal life in terms of what you'd want to do around children and all that kind of stuff. We just respect you and want you here because of the skills you have and what you contribute to the company and to the team that you're on. The rest of your life, you're an adult. You can figure it out. And we'll support you as far as we possibly can. Is this something that you're like kind of keeping up to date? Or are you encouraging contributions to this? If we share this around, would you be opposed to getting contributions from folks?
I would love to get contributions to it. And I feel like there haven't been that many lately. And I tried to get more during Hacktoberfest. So it would be great to keep it going on because I know it's an issue. I know that sometimes people are leery of adding those things because a lot of it is about having the bad experiences or the negative experiences with things. And I always say that moms are some of the most hardworking people that I know because we just don't have any time to waste, right? So we're using it as efficiently as we possibly can to make sure that we can accomplish all of the things that are required of us in a day. So I would absolutely love to really bring that forward. And actually, that gives me an idea for a project. So I might go buy a domain after this. So yes. Please submit more PRs and contributions to that repo.
Thanks so much, Becca, for joining me on the podcast. There's so much great information and knowledge that you've shared. Yeah, I really, really appreciate it. Thanks so much for everything you do. Thanks for the community you run, all the work that you do, all the just positivity you put out of there. In closing, anything you want to leave us with? How can people find you? How can people support you?
Thanks. I am Becca HW pretty much everywhere. So that's BEKAH and then another HW. So you can go ahead and find me on Twitter or Instagram, or that's my website too, BeccaHW.com, and on dev. Anyway, find me there. It's great to connect. And I always love to hear from folks. One of the most meaningful DMs I got was recently somebody watched my keynote from that conference last January, and they DM'd me to let me know how impactful it was for them. And I think that anytime somebody is sharing the things that you're doing, it's so nice to get those messages. So if there's somebody out there that's given a talk, written a blog post, created a course that you really love, reach out to them and let them know that you love it because it helps us to keep going.
100% agree. Thanks so much, Becca. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Mycelium Network podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with your friends. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Have something to add? Continue the conversation on GitHub and join the community on Slack. Until the next one, keep making the web awesome.